My brother keeps a human head in his closet. I hope I don't end up that way.
This thing, it's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me, and I passed it to you. It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. It could look like anyone.
Help!
Santa Claus only brings presents to them that's been good all year. To the ones that ain't done nothing naughty. All the other ones. All the naughty ones. He punishes you. See Santa Claus tonight? You better run, boy. You better run for your life.
Bring me one of those chickens.
You got money to pay for it?
You paid for it.
No, but we're the king's men. So, you got money?
Not a penny. I'll still take that chicken.
You don't seem to understand the situation.
I understand that if any more words come pouring out your mouth, I'm going to have to eat every chicken in this room.
You lived your life for the king. You're going to die for some chickens.
Someone is.
Symbol is associated with a pagan deity named Bagul. He consumes the souls of human children. Early Christians believed that Bagul actually lived in the images themselves and that they were gateways into his realm.
I am seriously positive these were not here. How would we have, like, just made a campsite in between three piles of rocks just by coincidence? You don't think this is strange?
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you?
I am well.
And in the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, also. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Abe.
Hey, how's it going, man?
I'm pretty good, pretty good.
Excellent, very well. Before we begin, this is Dark Discussions Podcast. November 5th is the recording. And
remember the 5th of November. I don't remember the rest, but there's a more of this clever rhyme.
Is that from, like, Alice in Wonderland or something?
It's Guy Fawkes Day.
Yeah, the guy, something about the gunpowder plot.
Yes.
Did you watch
V for Vendetta?
Yeah, I actually did. Anything with Natalie Portman in, I most certainly watch. And, I do remember that now. Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it on Stitcher and on the iTunes Store.
Oh, very good. And Mike, you do a genre blog?
That's the rumor. Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com.
And Abe, you do a genre book.
Yep, it's called A Reeler Movie Reviewer. Reeler spelled R-E-E-L-E-R Movie Reviewer. You can find it by searching your basic through maybe your search engine, or you can go to the Dark Discussions main page and look on your right-hand side. You'll find the links to my blog, as well as those mentioned by Eric and Mike, along with a few other goodies as well.
That's right, and that is www.darkdiscussions.com. Yeah, that's from some commercial. And on the right of the front page are links to those things, as Abe said, and at the bottom of every page of darkdiscussions.com are links to the podcast on iTunes, the Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast, the email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, the Stitcher account, the RSS feed, and a few other things, I believe. And also on darkdiscussions.com are all the episodes of the podcast. Before we begin, anybody have any genre news they wanted to mention? Anything of note? Anyone? Go ahead.
The Ash vs. Evil Dead series premiered last Saturday.
Yes, and you saw it then?
I did.
Oh, all right, go ahead.
I thought it was really fun. It's they're 45 minutes episodes, so It's, you don't quite get the full, like Evil Dead movie experience, but it's certainly got the same personality. And I think it'll improve as the other characters get developed.
My understanding is that the 45 minutes was just the first episode.
Oh, they're supposed to be longer or shorter?
Shorter.
Okay.
Okay.
So
and
be 30 minutes?
There should probably like closer to 30 minutes. And the first one was directed by Sam Raimi.
Mm-hmm.
So that certainly would explain the similarity in tone. But my understanding is that for people who have like reviewed it and seen, you know, the
future.
The future episodes, yes. They've looked into the future and seen, they said it still manages to maintain it, so that doesn't seem to be a concern.
Cool.
And I actually think something works better with Ash at this point, with it being Bruce Campbell, the age he is.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's because...
I think it's even funnier because it's 30 years later and he still hasn't learned anything.
Well, right, because when Ash was young and stupid, he was just, that's just kind of young
and
stupid.
At least he had the excuse of being young. Now he's just stupid.
Yeah, now that we find out Ash is still a loser when he's 50-something years old, or and still a stock boy, working at, was it Value Mart or something like that? Because I guess they couldn't use S-Mart.
Yeah, it's not S-Mart, it's Value Mart or something like that.
Yeah, there was some sort of... there's some rights issues, which obviously the Evil Dead series has had before. Mm-hmm. So they've been able to use footage from Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, but not from Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
But presumably Army of Darkness still happened.
Yeah, and they're not allowed to use it because of rights or something like that?
Yeah,
So they're not going to make specific references to Army of Darkness necessarily?
They're just going to assume you know what happened.
Right, and like not being able to use S-Mart, as nice as that would have been, you know, that's not that big a deal, because obviously businesses over 30 years come and go.
Yeah, that's a good point. They were bought out, merged, Kmart and Sears, that type of thing. what's the big one, new one? Rite Aid and Walgreens.
That's right.
It does happen. Also, on the same night, the second season of the French genre television show The Returned was released as well. And that was on Sundance TV. You can get season one on Netflix, Sundance TV, and on demand right now, the first episode.
Which I don't think I've ever heard you mention it before. I'm assuming this is a new discovery for you, Phil?
Yes. There was a post I put on the Facebook group about Evil Dead and Ash and all that coming on Halloween. And then in the same article, it listed also Returned. And one of our listeners and contributors, David Koning, on the Facebook page, wrote, "Oh, The Returned is one of the best shows out there." And
it's
so
French.
I looked it up, found that it was on Netflix for season one, and I binged it last week. And I thought it was fantastic. I know, Eric, you at least took a peek at it because
I watched the first episode, and I can see that it's a very good show. But while I can get myself to stand still and read subtitles for the length of a movie, I don't know if I can do it for an entire television series. So
even
I'm going to end up abandoning that one,
even though it's an hour episodes and that's it.
Yeah, it's just it's too much.
But it's like, you know, 6 hour episodes. So,
right.
Yeah, I think it's an eight episode season.
Yes, yeah, so that's 8 hours of reading versus 90 minutes.
I see. And, you know, some people right now are listening to say and saying, "Oh my God, Eric, a typical American.
What the fuck ever."
But aren't most American movies like dubbed when they go into French?
They are. They are.
So, just like you goddamn French people.
Yeah. Or in
because
any,
there's,
any country for
they're
that
saying,
matter.
I don't want to read it in American.
English, yes. The show is very similar to The Leftovers, but the opposite instead. People coming back instead of people disappearing.
So right, it's a zombie show unlike any other. You know, it's a Not the Dead Return, but they're normal dead.
I don't know if they're zombies.
That's people joke about like Zombie Jesus. So it's or Zombie Jason. Just because you come back from the dead, technically doesn't mean you're a zombie, but it also means you're a zombie.
Right. Okay. And have you seen the show, Mike?
It's probably been over a year. I watched the pilot episode. It's been on Netflix, and I never got back to it. I believe AMC has done a remake of it.
They did, and it lasted one season, and it was canceled over the summer.
So, and I have no idea if that was any good or not. And, you know, I haven't heard a lot about the French series. You know, I knew it existed, but, like, I heard more about, say, In the Flesh, which was the I think now it's been two seasons, maybe three, BBC series. And I'd heard more about that or Black Mirror than I did about The Return. And that could simply be because it's French.
Right. Yeah. So it may not have as a wide audience for the fact that, as Eric mentioned, it's subtitled. But I highly recommend it. If you like The Leftovers, everybody who watches that show should most certainly watch The Returned. I think it's maybe a little better, and The Leftovers is kicking ass right now. So, also, a couple of deaths I wanted to mention. The first is Stephen Evans, one of our listeners, mentioned it, and I posted on Facebook. George Barris, the guy that did many movie cars, including the Batman car from the 1960s television show, passed away at the age of 89. And then Sinister Star, Fred Thompson, passed away in his mid to early 70s.
Oh, that's right. Fred Thompson. I like him.
So a couple of folks of interest for the genre community. Rest in peace, George Barris and Fred Thompson. You will be missed. Let's see what else. A new movie was released to theaters and is coming to VOD, I think, next Tuesday. And it was originally titled, and A brought it to our attention during the 2015 preview series, Zombies versus Boy Scouts or something like that, but it's now retitled to The Boy Scout Guide to the Survival of the Zombie Apocalypse or something like that.
Oh, I saw a preview for that. It actually looked like it could be amusing.
Yes. And so that should be coming out Tuesday the 11th. On VOD is what I have heard. And that's pretty much that.
It is out in theaters now. I was almost able to see it this afternoon, but if it's still in the theaters on Saturday, I'll probably catch it then.
Oh, so that you may be lucky enough to see it on the big screen. Very good. Hopefully you will, Mike. Hopefully you will. All right, any other news? If not, we can discuss a couple of things that people have seen of interest that folks may want to mention. Mike, why don't you start? If Eric, you think of anything, just bring it up when we get to you. But Mike, any items of interest, such as movies and whatnot, that are genre-related that you wanted to mention?
No, you know what? I'm forgetting. We did go see Paranormal Activity Ghost Dimension on Friday.
Oh, you and the wife, all right?
Yes. And she did not like it. We didn't have much time to discuss the reasons why she did not like it, but she did not like it. And I would have to say that while this is better than the fourth installment, it is a pretty weak installment overall. I enjoyed it more than the fourth installment because the fourth installment was just plain dull. And at least in this installment, things happen. Even if they don't happen in a particularly good way. So you're at least not bored. Part of the problem, I think, is that it is a lot of really cheap CGI. And there's like five scares of something just jumping at the camera. You know, just like something from the background go whoosh, you know, and boom, and hitting camera, knocking it over. And that's overused. There's, you know, you finally get to see by this gimmick of a altered camera. You know, you see what's going on around them. So you finally see all the stuff that you've not been seeing in the first couple of Paranormal Activity movies. And you really didn't need to see it. It's stuff floating in the air. It's black smog. It all is cheap CGI stuff. And there really it was no point in showing us that stuff because they don't use it to any great effect. And it's supposed to wrap up the story, and I admit I haven't seen any of the Paranormal Activity movies after their theatrical release. So I've seen them all like once, and that's it. So I'm not well steeped in the mythology of the Paranormal Activity series. And, you know, if this wraps up the series, I mean, yes, it mentions Katie and whatever her name is from the original three films. And they are featured in it a little bit, and but I'm not entirely sure how it ties all the threads together. I don't know that it makes a whole lot of sense. And the way it ends, it could be an end. It could be a beginning. They really, you know, didn't cap things off the way that I, you know, I think people might have been expecting, or certainly I was expecting. By people, therefore, I mean me. I don't know. The only thing I would recommend is that if you want to see it in 3D, you know, this will be your best chance, unless you own a 3D TV, in which case you can wait. I saw it. And I don't think I'm going to be sorry to see the franchise go. Like most horror franchises, it's got its, what is this, six centuries now? Paranormal Yikes, Four.
I think you're right. This is
yeah,
the
sixth. There is
Four. Six, yeah. And then the marked ones, right, the which was the Paranormal yep. Activity Espanol, yep. And then
well,
and then this
it,
one.
It was really not Espanol. I mean, it was.
Well, it was focused on the Hispanic family, right? It's
Yeah, that's right. That's right, yeah.
And then this one makes six. And like, you know, I said, all horror franchises, it continued until it beat the tar out of the horse and there was nothing left except cat food.
I understand. All right, so that means
I have some breaking news.
All right.
Literally, since Mike started talking about that movie, Bruce Campbell has tweeted that on November 10th, I don't know if it'll get out before then, but if it does, on November 10th at 12:30 Eastern, he will be doing an Ask Me Anything on Reddit.
All right. Awesome. Well, maybe I'll mention that. Or cut this piece out and put it in tomorrow's episode that I'm releasing.
Oh, I did hear he had said he wants both, because you mentioned, Eric, last week that there was a second season that's already been approved.
They've been greenlighted, yep.
Right, that he does want both Kane Hodder and Robert Englund to make appearances.
Nice.
So, now, I don't think they'll be able to get the characters, but it would be awesome if they could. If they could somehow get us Ash versus Jason versus Freddy, but
I know the internet horror movie geeks that were clamoring for that a while back.
So
I heard about, and I heard they were going to make like a comic book out of that too, or something.
They did. That's been around.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. All right. Very good. Very good. Anything else, Mike? You wanted to mention?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. What about you, Abe?
Honestly, not a whole lot. Still doing some reading the two books I have. The Hollower by Mary Sangiovanni. It's the first in a trilogy. The second book is Tribesmen by Adam Cesar, a novella.
Very good, very good. Yep, and I know both are available in online bookstores anyway, so... All right, very good, Abe. Let's see, what about yourself, Eric?
Oh, let's see, I've been watching some stuff. Last night I watched The Final Girls, not to be confused with Final Girl.
Big difference there in enjoyment.
Yes, big difference.
Yes.
The Final Girls, which I watched last night, was actually fairly amusing. I'm not going to call it a great movie, but it entertained me, so I wasn't disappointed. What else have I been watching? Oh, I've been watching a little bit of season 3 of American Horror Story.
And I heard it's getting better.
Well, you're probably thinking of the current season. I'm back on season 3.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But for some reason, I stopped halfway through the first time, and I don't remember why. So I'm going again, and I've gotten past where I stopped before. So I'm having fun with that. What else? Oh, and Dan and I watched a movie last weekend called Deathgasm. We watched that on Halloween. And that was actually a lot of fun. It's silly and gory. And all about the metal. So, if you like heavy metal and horror movies, it's a good combo.
And both of them are, I know, are on iTunes for VOD, yes. And probably the rest of their places too, Amazon or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Anything else, Eric?
I've been reading a book, Slowly But Surely, called The Border by Robert McCammon. I can't remember if I've mentioned it here before or not. I guess I would classify it more as sci-fi than as horror, because the main premise of the book is that apparently the Earth is on the border between two different dimensions, and two alien races are having a war, and we just get caught in the middle of it. And that's the premise of the book. So that's an interesting one I've been reading.
All right. Very good. Very good. For myself, I have seen a couple of films. I don't know if I've mentioned them already, but I'll throw them out. The Editor, brand new release. It's now on Blu-ray by Scream Factory, 2015 released throughout the world, I guess. Prior to that, 2014, it was doing the festival circuits. High recommend, really good film. It does what it's supposed to do very well, which is to make it look like it's a 1975 European slasher or a giallo, and they do it excellent. It's the same folks, the Canadians up in that did Father's Day. They're the same directors, writers, producers, and whatnot. Astron 6, I think, is the name of the company. So high recommend there. Folks who want to check that film out should definitely do it. Stars, one of the stars is Paz de la Huerta, who was in Nurse 3D, as well as numerous other things and television. I saw a 1980s film, Breeders. Got it on Blu-ray, came the other day, and it's a good cheesy sci-fi horror exploitation film from the 80s. So if you can get over the 80s cheese, you'll enjoy it. And then I saw two shows, episodes that left pretty good feelings in me. The first was episode 4 of The Leftovers, and the latest episode of The Walking Dead. And I'm not sure if you've seen that episode, Mike?
Yes, I have.
Okay, and what did you think of The Walking Dead episode? I think there was a lot of outrage because they do these cliffhangers where they switch back and forth with characters instead of following the storyline. So there's been a lot of backlash, similar to the Beth episodes from last year. And if they did it in chronological order, this should have been like episode 1 or 2 of the season, maybe. But as a standalone episode, what did you think, Mike?
It was interesting. I don't know that it was planned out to be in a 90-minute episode, which is what it ended up being, but they basically let the actors, because it's mostly a two-person show, they let the actors sort of take their time instead of rushing through them through their scenes, and so probably ended up playing out that way. I think the actors overcome the material, because when you really stop and think about the new character's backstory and his history, it's unbelievably convenient that he happens to be in that place at that time and connect with that character. You know, it's like, you know, boy, is that just a perfect metaphor. So a lot of very convenient stuff. But while you watch it, I think it was engaging, especially considering just how full throttle the first 3 episodes have been. And it's also, whether it's intentional or not, a giant Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle Easter egg, because the character's name is Eastman, who is the name of one of the creators of the Ninja Turtles. One scene he's wearing a t-shirt with the turtle on it. One scene he's wearing a t-shirt with pizza on it. You know, and they've got pictures of turtles throughout his house. So I just...
he's talking about Kevin Eastman, basically.
Yes, and plus he's using a bow staff, so he's Donatello, which I just kind of found funny. And ironically, he was taught how to use the bow staff by the guy who played Donatello in the original Ninja Turtles movie. But That's why I kind of got a kick out of that. But it's a decent episode, and it fills in a character's backstory, and it certainly gives you some food for thought philosophically, I guess, going forward over the idea of something we've had sort of conversations about, which is, you know, is all life precious, and is it justifiable to kill somebody, and if so, under what circumstances? And
when I feel like it.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because as a result of that episode, you know, I've heard people have conversations, and certainly I've mentioned what's the name of the Walking Dead cast, which is hosted by two people from San Francisco. So as you can imagine, neither one is exactly on the conservative end of the political spectrum. Yeah. And both of them have, you know, mentioned, I think, in the past that they're nonviolent, and they don't necessarily – I don't think they've mentioned that they're not in favor of the death penalty. And yet, this character from The Walking Dead have gone so far, you know, that they're like, well, I don't know if I could justify not killing that person because they want to kill my family and eat my baby. You know, it's just sort of – I think I might have to kill them in that circumstance. We're not talking about living in society. We're talking about the zombie apocalypse. But that's, I think, what makes The Walking Dead a water cooler show, is that it does trigger those conversations. You know, if you have somebody tied up in your basement who is vowed to kill you as soon as they get out, and yet you don't believe in killing, what do you do?
Right.
And most people go, kill the fucker. But
no, that's fair. That's fair. Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, if the pacifist says life is precious, which is true, and then the more, I don't want to say realist, but the more, whatever the opposite is, they would say, yeah, but sociopaths can't change, therefore eliminate them. So it's a good question. Or I don't know. The episode was very interesting that way. I mean, I didn't even catch the Ninja Turtle references, and it's funny that they got the same actor that played the Ninja Turtles as the actor to be the co-star in this episode. But
well, no, it's the actor, the behind the scenes, the actor who plays the guy was coached how to use his bow staff by the guy who played Donatello in the original movie.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Oh, okay, all right. So it's a little different, but still.
Yeah, cool. I can't imagine there's a whole lot of bow staff experts in Hollywood, so that kind of makes sense.
Right.
But
yes. The philosophical point is really good point, because
it does tie in with, I think, what this episode's going to focus on with tonight's movie. Is the idea of all life is precious. But you also have to recognize that there's a difference between saying all life is precious in a society where you can call the police and have somebody locked up, and right. In one in which there is no greater authority.
Right.
The law.
And Mike, did you see the Leftover episode?
I'm not. We've only seen the one episode of The Leftovers so far.
Oh, okay. All right. And that episode has the similar thing, which is all life is precious type of thing in it. And so it kind of ties in with the movie we're going to discuss tonight, as well as the Walking Dead episode itself. My personal opinion is that was one of the best Walking Dead episodes ever. But again,
there are a lot of people who would agree with you. It is a bit heavy handed. But like I said, it's a lot of it forced and very, you know, isn't that convenient.
Yeah, but you know what? It's the Walking Dead is very heavy-handed the other way, with Rick saying, if they fall behind, just kill them all, or leave them behind. You know, and it's like there's the good people like Bob and all these other people that get wiped out, and then there's the people that are becoming slightly more survivalists like Rick. And you could even argue that his side is heavy-handed too.
Well, his side is heavy. He's heavy-handed, but I don't think the show is necessarily advocating that he's in a healthy place mentally.
Well, that's fair.
So I don't think it's. I think it's one. It's. I'm just saying that. I mean, there are other things like symbolism in that story. That for example, the symbolism of the cage in the episode was, yeah, I think, somewhat heavy-handed and convenient. But you just happen to find the one guy in the world who has a cabin in the woods in the middle of nowhere with its own solar power. And a cage, a prison cell, you know, inside. You know,
before that, you were talking about how Rick was being a mental illness.
Well, that Rick is at a point, and this has always been something that series has bounced back and forth with. It's and explored with Rick's character. In fact, if you look at where his character has gone, like you have the thing in this episode where Eastman's looking at the driver's license, right, and using that of the zombies and using that to carve graves for them, which is something Rick had done in the second episode of the series.
That's correct.
So Rick was at one point. At one point, he said, "You know, we don't kill the living." Well, he's obviously come far past that because, you know, when the living try to rape and murder your child or try to eat you and your friends, they tend to lose some of their privileges.
Right. Or just killing someone that has a behavioral health issue like alcoholism, like he did at the end of last season.
I don't know that he killed somebody just for, well.
The doctor.
Well, he was beyond alcoholism. He was abusive, and he had murdered somebody.
I see your point. Spoilers. But either way, it was probably it was different than self defense murder.
And he was given a green light to do that. But yeah, but I mean, and you compare that to Carol, where in the previous episode, right, you had the assault on Alexandria, tied somebody up. They caught one of the bad guys. They tied him up, and Carol just walks through and blows him away without.
That's right.
Without need or without saying, "Hey, do you mind if I shoot this guy?"
Sure.
So yeah, you do have characters of all different stripes, but obviously the fans tend to root for the blow them away people than the save them.
Right, right. I'm probably one of the few that are an exception.
Oh yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Right. All right. Very good. But,
but as we all know, that nobody who's good and kind and represents all that's wonderful of humanity will survive The Walking Dead. So,
the screenwriter's choice.
Evil will always triumph over good because good is dumb.
Well, I do wonder, like, is this because if that's a deliberate choice of the writers? Or sort of like how they kept killing off black people the first three seasons or four seasons. Is it just sort of, oh, we didn't realize we were doing that?
Right. That's fair. That's fair. So we'll find out anyway. But that's how it's been going, at least right from the starting. All right. So very good. So that's the part Eric dreads. And either way, The Leftovers is similar to that, but that life is precious, and it was a very good episode as well. So with that stated, I think we can get into our main topic tonight. And Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight we're going to be talking about the movie starring Matt Damon, The Martian.
I guarantee you that at some point everything's going to go south on you.
Ready?
And you're going to say, this is it. This is how I end.
Commander, Mark is dead.
We have to go. Yeah.
Now, you can either accept that, or you can get to work.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates. And to NASA. And to the entire world. But I'm still alive. Surprise. Here's the rub. It's going to be 4 years for another mission to reach me. And I'm in a hab designed to last 31 days. So I got to make water and grow food on a planet where nothing grows. But if I can't figure out a way to make contact with NASA, then none of this matters anyway.
We've got an incoming message.
Mein Gott.
Mark Watney is still alive.
Woo! In your face, Neil Armstrong. There must be some kind
of way out of here. Okay, so let's do the math. I have enough food to last for 50 days.
He's going to starve to death long before we can help.
So, I'm going to have to science the shit out of this.
He's 50 million miles away from home. He's totally alone. What the hell is he thinking right now?
I am the greatest botanist on this planet.
I know how to save Mark Watney.
But we need the Hermes crew.
We either have a high chance of killing one or a low chance of killing six.
I'm not risking their lives.
It's bigger than one person.
No. It's not.
NASA rejected the mission.
So if we do this?
We're talking mutiny. If anything goes wrong, we die.
Do you realize how crazy this is?
We had no other option.
No matter what happens, tell the world, tell my family, that I never stop fighting to make it home.
That's right. The Martian is a novel written by someone. Well, it was originally a novel, right, Eric? 2014 yes. was when it was released by Crown Publishing. It was originally released as self-published in 2011. Crown Publishing or some agent or whatnot saw it, said, oh, we got to get this book, put it out, and made the writer, Andy Weir, a multimillionaire because of it. Andy Weir, the writer, was born in California, and he is a 43-year-old individual, computer programmer originally. So, he worked as a programmer for such companies as AOL, Palm, and Blizzard.
That which, makes perfect
on,
sense.
And worked on Warcraft, as a matter of fact. So, the movie, is directed by, someone named Ridley Scott, probably most known for Alien, Blade Runner, and among other films, including most recently Prometheus and Exodus. A couple other people of interest. Simon Kinberg produced the film. He's a guy that's done numerous films, such as the X-Men films, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and so forth. The screenwriter, someone of significance for fans of genre, Drew Goddard, director of Cabin in the Woods, as well as Cloverfield, and he wrote numerous,
he was also a longtime writer on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes, yep, that's what I was about to say. And Eric, thank you very much for bringing that up. Also of note is such folks as the cinematographer Darius Wojcicki. He's a gentleman from Poland. And he's done a number of big films as well, including The Pirates of the Caribbean, Dark City, Crimson Tide, The Crow, Prometheus, Exodus, The Walk, which just came out, The Martian, so has a quite an impressive resume. The film editor, Pietro Scalia, American, and then the last person that I wanted to mention behind the scenes would be Harry Gregson-Williams, who was the composer. He's done a number of major films as well, including the Chronicles of Narnia films and numerous X-Men films, Shrek, and Chicken Run, Phone Booth, Spy Game. So a lot of really Bridget Jones, so very, very various types of films. The film stars, as you mentioned, Matt Damon, most famous probably for Good Will Hunting, Bond films, and so forth. But it does have a fantastic supporting cast of many character actors, including Jeff Daniels, Sean Bean, Jessica Chastain, Kate Mara, Michael Pena, Benedict Wong, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Kristen Wiig, among others. And that's behind the scenes. So it's a 2015 film, just came out, and it is pretty much the box office hit of the fall, right? I mean, this film has been around for, what, 4, 5, 6 weeks now, and it's been...
Mm-hmm. We're on there, yeah. It was first came out on September 11th, and I think it's already finished its run in theaters, or it's still out? Is it?
Oh, no, it's still in theaters, and in fact, this weekend, Spectre came along, and it was finally able to knock it out of the IMAX theater at my local showcase. Because the Martians, IMAX theater for since it opened.
Yeah, and the film was actually been in the top three for box office since it's come out. It has survived that long and actually won the box office last week, Abe, as the top film of the week, and that is week at least week five or six. So it's still this we haven't seen anything like this since maybe Titanic or the Star Wars prequels where a film
Avatar, you had Dark Knight, but yeah, it's
budget of $108 million so far. It's grossed $185 million.
Well, that's in North America.
Yes, that's the US. Mm-hmm.
But all throughout the world, it's over 400. Million right now. So anyway, that's that. I guess we can discuss our experience at the theater, when we saw it, how we heard about it.
Phil, before we get there,
yes,
I just want to make a note. I have read the book as well. And even if you do see this movie, the book is still totally worth reading, because he goes into such detail in the book. That they really kind of had to iron it out to condense it into a movie. So they cut some stuff out and simplified some other stuff. And there's a lot of great rich detail in the book that those of us of the nerdlier inclination, particularly those of us into science and such, might really enjoy reading the book in addition to watching the movie.
Now, Eric, when you said you read the book, was that actually reading it or was it an audiobook?
No, I read it.
Oh, very good. And, and I can believe what you stated because, I mean, the film alone was 2 hours and 21 minutes, which is a fairly long film for nowadays.
And it was still a total Reader's Digest version of the book.
Yes, interesting. One question I do have about the book, I mean, you can mention a bunch of things as we go and discuss the film, but I had a curiosity. There's a scene about how NASA gets help from the Chinese Space Department in the movie. Is that actually in the book, or is that just
in the book, but it makes a lot more sense in the book.
Okay, so it wasn't just put in so they could get Chinese marketing?
No. It was in the book, but they go a lot more into the behind-the-scenes political machinations. Whereas in the movie, they're just like, we're all human, so let's get along.
Yes, right, exactly. and it kind of was that way in the movie. All right, so let's discuss where we heard the film and all this other stuff. So, Eric, why don't you start and give us your experience. Did you see it in IMAX, all that stuff?
I did see it in IMAX. I can't remember heard the film.
Does that mean 3D when you say IMAX? Because
I can't remember if I saw it in 3D.
This is in 3D. That doesn't have to be in 3D. So
I saw just IMAX. Like, my preferred viewing experience is IMAX with no 3D, and I think I got to see this like that.
Okay.
And I saw a preview for it at some point. And I heard somebody else say, well, this is basically like that one scene from Apollo 13. Where they got to figure out how to make stuff work for stuff it wasn't designed to do, and it's a whole movie of it. And they said it with a negative slant, but I was like, hey, that scene was awesome. Sign me up. So then I found out it was a book, and I went and read the book before the movie came out, and then went and saw the movie on opening day.
Very good. And how many folks were in the theater when you went?
Oh, it was packed.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. So you saw it on opening day. So yeah, it would be packed. Yeah. Very good. My experience, I didn't even know Ridley Scott was coming out with a film until we did our 2015 preview episode of Dark Discussions, which was done back in January. And then that was one of the films that one of us brought up. I think I may have actually brought it up, and I had only found out about it that day when I was doing research of films to look forward to. And that's pretty much all I knew about it. I knew about the book because the book is an interesting story because it was self-published and someone noticed that it was such a great book that a guy that basically wrote a book, didn't get any support for it. Suddenly it was lucked out that someone saw how good it was and made millions because it was picked up. So that's an interesting backstory on that. And I actually saw the film Tuesday night of this week, so just a couple of days ago. And it was only two other folks in the theater with me. And that's pretty much my experience with the movie. What about you, Abe?
For me, I believe it was a couple of weeks ago, me and my father, managed to catch a late night show, in 3D. We haven't had a couple other people, in our theater, maybe about a couple, an older couple and maybe a family there. It was during the slower part of the film's release.
Okay. What about you, Mike?
I finally caught it yesterday. The fact that it's been doing so well has kind of kept me from seeing it because, you know, it was a matter of, well, it'll still be there. And we kept pushing back this podcast. And I said, well, I don't have to see it right now. I don't have to see it right. And now it finally got to the point where the showings have gotten fewer and fewer. And so I went yesterday to catch a 7 o'clock show, which was the 3D show. And they found out they're renovating the local AMC theater, which is why there were so few showings, because half their theaters are out of commission. And they're putting in, like, comfortable seats so that you can fall asleep and not actually see the entire movie. And I went in. I was the only person in there for a while, and then one person joined me. And I sat through 25 minutes of trailers that were all Oscar bait trailers. Look at so-and-so. Look at so-and-so. Try to win an award was basically the title of all the films. And then it started off with, the opening prologue about the future computer revolution. And I slowly realized, oh, shit, I'm in the wrong theater. That was it. things were a bit confusing because the things have been going under renovations. And I was sitting in at the opening of the Steve Jobs movie. And it also wasn't
it's your worst nightmare.
I was also thinking it was really crappy 3D because it was in 2D. But fortunately that movie started 5 minutes. I was concerned because
that's,
I guess
that's the story ever.
I was concerned because, like I said, there were like 25 minutes worth of trailers.
Right.
And they just must have started about the same time. And fortunately, the movie actually hadn't started yet. So I was able to get in and get a good seat. It was for a film that has been out for over a month, close to 2 months. And for a Wednesday night screening, it was well attended still. And that's – so anyway, that's how I finally saw it, thankfully. I was deathly afraid I was going to, like, miss the opening of the movie. And I'd be like, okay, I don't know what happened. How did he get on Mars? What happened? Why is he alone?
Right. No, that would have sucked. All right. Very well. All right. So let's discuss our opinions of the film. I'll start, I guess. Yeah, I was not – pleasantly surprised because I knew it was going to be a good film based off of the reviewers and what I've heard, and sure enough it was a fantastic film. Very suspenseful. Mike, I think you said it, a very good feel-good film. Talks about how all human life is precious and has a good thing to say about humanity and so forth. Fit perfectly with The Walking Dead and the Leftovers episodes I saw this past weekend. So 5 hours of feel good. So I would say it's one of the better films of the year. I'm not sure where it will fall, except that will most certainly be in the top 10 best other genre films of the year that will probably make lists of, as we do at the end of every year for Dark Discussions. I was surprised to see some actors I like, Kate Mara, Sean Bean, Jeff Daniels.
I didn't even recognize Jeff Daniels.
Yeah. Oh, really? No kidding.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's still very recognizable, but I guess it's if you haven't seen him in anything for a while.
Last thing I saw him in was The Big Lebowski.
That was Jeff Bridges.
Oh, no wonder I'm so confused.
Yeah. So it's Jeff Daniels, yeah.
Jeff Daniels is the guy from Dumb and Dumber and Dumb and Dumberer.
Oh, that makes so much more sense.
Yes.
Just picture him having a you know the shits in the toilet, and that'll be.
Right. Well, and it's kind of odd that he hasn't seen anything with Jeff Bridges in it because he was in Iron Man and so many other things. He won an Academy Award just a year ago or something. So,
well, I watched The Big Lebowski most recently, I should say.
Ah, very good.
No, I was talking about the wrinkle, the configuration of his face as he's gotten older.
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, also Chiwetel Ejiofor was in it as well, and this. He's having a pretty damn good year for science fiction films because this year and Z for Zachariah, which will most certainly make my top 10 other genre films. He was a star in that as well, and so it was good to see him as well. And Michael Pena from numerous films, including Crash and such, was in it. So
he was in End of Watch, wasn't he?
I don't know. I didn't see that film.
I think he was, and that was a damn good movie.
But yeah, it was good to see Sean Bean too. Jessica Chastain, I think her part could have been replaced with any actress because it wasn't necessary to have quote unquote a bigger name in that role, based off of the amount of screen time and such. But, she did a fine job as well. So, yes, I enjoyed the film a lot. High recommend and folks should most certainly see it. I only saw it on the regular screen, not 3D, and it still was a fantastic viewing. What about you, Eric? Your opinions and such?
Well, I thought it was, like I said, I read the book first, so I knew the whole deal going in. I thought the adaptation did a really good job of slashing as much as they needed to slash without ruining the story. It did suffer a little bit, but not for anybody who's watching the movie, only for people who have also read the book, if that makes any sense. And I understand the reasons for it, too, because there's just a massive amount of material. I thought everybody in the movie did a fantastic job. And I personally found it interesting to see two completely different facets of Jessica Chastain's acting range in The Martian and Crimson Peak. Because Phil's not wrong that it didn't have to be, you know, Jessica Chastain in this role. It wasn't a groundbreaking role, but it was a very different one from what she did in Crimson Peak. So it's kind of interesting.
It kind of made me think of like one of those, for a lot of these, because they were small parts, that, oh, I want the chance to work with Ridley Scott kind of things.
Yeah, it could be. I enjoyed the movie a great deal, and I highly recommend it, and I recommend the book even higher. But yeah, you should try and catch this in the theater, because it is visually and aurally impressive.
Now, Eric, I have one question for you. Another high-profile director did another high-profile book last year and brought it to theaters, and that movie as well was a huge success both financially, critically, and by audiences alike, and that was Gone Girl by David Fincher. Was this adaption equally as good as David Fincher's doing of Gone Girl? Since you read both
books. Almost. I mean, the thing of it is, they had to cut some more from The Martian to get it on the screen. Because in the book, there's a lot of just, I mean, he goes into the actual mathematical formulas that he's coming up with to do what he has to do. They cut out at least two, fairly significant disasters that happened to the Matt Damon character along the way just to save time in the movie. And they changed one of the disasters they kept in to simplify it, again for time. So the whole thing was just condensed, In that manner, I don't think it was quite as good of an adaptation as Gone Girl, because Gone Girl still managed to keep pretty much the entire story in there, whereas The Martian chopped some of it out. But I think they both ended up with very entertaining forms, movie forms of the book.
Very good. All right, Mike, what about you?
Let me throw this out there. I have not read the book.
You would love the book, Mike.
I might, but I think the challenge might have been greater because Gone Girl, when you get down to it, is still a thriller.
Right.
And we've a thriller like many, many others we've seen. Superbly done. But you're adapting a thriller. With this, there's so much technical stuff, and from what you're saying, even more technical stuff in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that makes it, as an adaptation, much harder to have done, and, yes, and they pull it off. I like the movie a lot. If you're forced to make comparisons, I mean, this is the fourth space disaster film I can think of, right? You had Apollo 13, Gravity, Interstellar, and this, sort of. And I think I like this one third, above Interstellar, but behind the other two.
Okay.
And for reasons, for stuff. I do think that, we'll get it into, I do think that if you're making a statement about how precious life is, there is no better way to do that than to cast Sean Bean in your film and not kill him.
There you go.
he gets fired, though.
Well, he resigned. Yes, he does. Yeah. But he survives. That's the important thing. He gets banished to the wall, but he keeps his head.
That's right.
I don't know that in reality that the world would be all that concerned about Matt Damon on Mars. George Clooney, maybe. Brad Pitt, maybe. Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, and Kevin Smith would be upset, but...
I have to disagree, because it's been proven that Matt Damon has made more money financially, his films, than George Clooney ever has made. George Clooney has been a box office failure, believe it or not. But continue. I do,
as others have pointed out, that we have spent far too much money rescuing Matt Damon. We had to rescue him in Interstellar. We had to rescue him in Saving Private Ryan. Now we're rescuing him from Mars. He just keeps getting further and further away, and we keep spending money chasing after him. I do, like I said, I think it was a really well done film. It's very hard to do. I think this is a film, being a science nerd, science background, science teacher, I do think, like, I do get kids in my class that, like, I've had girls who want to be forensic anthropologists because they've seen Bones or something like that. And, you know, this is the kind of film that I guarantee you will be inspiring kids to want to go into, probably at first they'd want to go into botany, then they'd go, oh, that's just plants? Well, fuck that. Let me go into engineering. But that will, I'm sure, inspire a lot of people to look into the sciences, and will do a lot more for that than any of your government, you can be a scientist too programs, whatever it is that they try to come up with to promote science. It's one of these things where my understanding is the book, they use my favorite word quite a bit, and they toned it down. And it's one of those things.
I thought they did a clever.
What word?
They kept it in as much as they could in a very clever way without hearing
what
it.
What word?
The F-bomb.
Okay. And oddly, the book is only 387 pages. So.
And I understand about 285 of those are the F-word.
Nah, that's an exaggeration.
But anyway, so as someone who appreciates the word, I would have liked to see it more. But on the other hand, I also think this is the kind of thing I'd love to see kids to see. And that would deprive that. Now, I understand that's not a concern of 99% of the viewing public. But yeah, I really enjoyed the film. I liked the film a lot. I think the idea that we still have a credible space program in the future is far-fetched. That's much more likely we'll be rescuing the Chinese and the Russians from Mars at this point. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I highly recommend it. It's going to be. I don't think it'll be my top film for the year. Just for minor reasons. Again, when you get up there, it's nitpicking. But it's a solid film, and it's strongly recommended.
To be honest, Mike, I for a genre film, horror or other genre, I have no issues by you saying that it shouldn't be the best horror of the year, because I don't think it's the best of the year for me either. I've seen better genre films that cost less than $500,000 than and at least two of them, and
like, that would be like Zombievers.
That was actually a good film, but I'm talking about It Follows and These Final Hours. I actually think were better films, and they cost nothing. But
I also thought Ex Machina was better than this.
I would agree with that, Eric. That's a really good point.
Yeah, and it's and I will say I didn't realize. Would you say the budget was $105 million?
About that.
Yeah, and they really get a lot for that money. And I know there's a lot of the movie is people in rooms with ties talking, you know. When you stop and think about it, but those are not usually the scenes that stand out in your head. Sure. You know, a lot of there's all the space scenes and things like that. The one thing I will say is because I did see it in 3D. Abe, did you see it in 3D?
Yes.
I am finding this annoying is the number of movies where they use 3D and you see 3D images on a 2D screen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you got a video screen and you have the pixels from the video screen blown up to movie screen proportion. So you clearly see the pixel like sort of as a curtain in front of the images behind it. And like you're showing
me. One of my friends was complaining about that too.
You're showing me a 2D screen with 3D in 3D. That makes no sense at all.
No, it doesn't.
It's you know, it's sort of like if you know you were doing a 3D movie in an art gallery and the Mona Lisa was suddenly in 3D. It's no, it wouldn't work that way, you know, and it's artificial and that sort of takes me out, but that's again nitpicking. And once it's on home video, I won't be watching it in 3D anymore, so it's not a big deal.
All right, very well. Interesting bringing up, I knew Abe would at least bring up Gravity and Interstellar, but also Apollo 13.
Eric brought that up, right? And yeah. I, you know, almost every review I read was, and if you take that one scene from Apollo 13, which is my favorite scene from Apollo 13, probably. So it's I don't have a problem with that, but most of the people have said it in a good light. I don't think it's an entirely apt comparison, but I think it's reasonable enough.
Right. Now, before we get to A, what is this scene that you and Eric are referring to? Because I'm not sure which one you're talking about.
It's where they're running out, or the air scrubber. They're building up, I think, carbon dioxide in the capsule.
Yeah.
Because the air scrubber broke.
Okay.
And so they have to manufacture a new filter based on, and they throw out all the stuff on the table and they say.
They got to fit a square filter in a round thing.
Oh, yes. And this is the material we have to work with. Figure it out.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay. Right. Yeah, that's true. All right, Abe. What's your opinion in the Crimson Peak episode? You mentioned that you liked the film and compared it to Interstellar and Gravity and said it was better than both of those. Tell us your opinion of the film.
I found it really engaging, and it didn't really need. I mean, it only had a few big set piece scenes. Because most of the time, as you mentioned, it's mostly, or as Mike mentioned, there's a lot of heavy dialogue scenes where people are discussing plans and what to do and stuff. But my attention was still hooked because there was so much personality in this film. It has serious moments, but it also just, as I said, has a lot of sense of fun, a good sense of humor, balances things out, and I think it helped that we didn't spend all the time in the film's runtime with just Matt Damon's character. We also focus on other members of NASA and other individuals and how they're dealing with the situation. And the movie had slow moments too, but even those moments were very interesting because, for example, seeing Matt Damon figure his solutions to his dilemma, you know, how to make food, how to stay warm, power sources, travel and stuff like that. It was just really cool to see how his mind worked. If anything could hook me to want to be to join the space program, but just wanted to be as smart as that. And as I said beforehand too, it was just it. I think that personality of this film is something that really I found that Interstellar really lacks in its slower moments. Because a lot of times Interstellar was just very dragging and very slow and very. I think it maybe just felt maybe there was some fat on that film that may be cut. And I was really impressed with Gravity's visuals and some of the acting. I did feel that it didn't really, I guess kind of, I don't know. I just kind of started losing me in some points of the film. I would say the film was perfect. I mean, Eric mentioned a number of things from the book. The book were cut. So I'm very curious as to, you know, what those things were and, you know, maybe just read the novel for myself at some point. But overall, I found this to be a very satisfying experience, high recommendation, and who knows, maybe it'll be in my top 10 by the end of this year.
All right, very good. Mike, it was interesting how you, where you put, when you brought up the film, and it, because I didn't really think of it and how to compare it. I would most certainly say it's better than Interstellar. I think Interstellar was the worst of the four films by far. I don't think that was really a good film at all. It was decent, and it was well done, well directed, well acted, well, you know, everything.
Too fucking long.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And the story just was not that good. So I didn't like that film much at all. Probably the first film by Christopher Nolan that I can honestly say that I'll probably never watch again.
And you had Space Ghost, and if a Space Ghost without tying into the Hanna-Barbera cartoon. So, you know, it just, you know, you're trying to do a sort of a hard science movie with this schmaltzy, touchy-feely Space Ghost storyline. So,
sure, sure. Yeah, and which of course there was a big twist even on that at the end. But generally, the film was just not that good in my opinion. At least my opinion. Gravity, I think, could have been better, but the ending of that film makes it fall a little behind this one in my opinion. Apollo 13, I just haven't seen it in some time to really compare it, so I wouldn't be able to place it there. So I don't know what you other. I know Mike, you said your opinion generally. What about you, Eric? Out of the four films, Abe already said his.
Probably Gravity would be number one, followed by this, followed by Apollo 13, and then Interstellar.
Okay. Yeah.
Although the first three I really, really like, and the Interstellar would be significantly behind the others.
Yeah, yeah, I would say the first three are fairly close on the plateau. So you could interchange and say, oh, that one's better, that one's better, that one's better. And I don't think anybody would complain, to be honest. All right, so that's that. So why don't we give a synopsis of the film before we go into our points, opinions, comparisons with the book, whatever we want to talk about, and throw up the spoiler alert. So, Eric, why don't you give a little wiki or IMDb or just your personal one that you're thinking up in your head of
Matt something. Damon gets stuck on Mars and we go get him back.
The yeah, end.
That's right. And basically what happens, Mars mission doesn't explain how we got there. You know, it's just assumed that, you know, technology's advanced in the past 10 years or whatever.
Yeah, this is the third Mars mission.
Yep, there you go. Ares 3, it's called. So I assume that would end. Ares is Mars, right? The Greek god. Mm-hmm. His name versus the Italian name of Mars, same person though.
It's actually Roman at the time.
Yeah, I was thinking he was named after my cat, but okay.
So a group of what is it? Five? Is it five or six? No, it's six, right? And there's a sandstorm on Mars. Matt Damon gets hit by debris. His life support system computer says he's dead. And so they take off, they leave him. And what happens is that it just malfunctioned, because, you know, that well, I guess it was more than malfunction. I mean, a spike went through it and actually pierced his body, but he was not dead. It was just malfunction. And of course
in the book, they make it much clearer that by all rights, he should have died. And it was basically a minor miracle that his blood actually stopped up the hole in the space suit.
Oh, that's actually a cool thing that, yeah, they don't even mention in the movie at all.
No, they do, but it's very quickly.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah, I so quickly, I didn't even notice it. And so basically they think he's dead. They announce it, to the press, and then suddenly, one of the workers at NASA sees pictures through orbit from a satellite around Mars that the NASA's put up there, that things are moving on Mars, meaning, uh-oh, he's not dead. And so it's their need now to try to get him back. And then the other story, the second story, or probably the A story, would be how Matt Damon survives and tries to communicate back to Earth. So, hey, get me back. And since this is in quote unquote hard science fiction, it's going to take years. So we're talking like 400, 500 days. So a year and a half to 2 years for this to be accomplished. All right. So we'll throw up a spoiler alert. And we will discuss the film. Who wants to start? Who wants to bring up anything? Go ahead. Anyone.
Well, did anyone have any doubt that they were getting Matt Damon back?
No.
I actually did. Well, you know what it was? I was thinking he was going to make it. I figured everybody was going to survive. But then I'm thinking, you know what? They could pull the rug out under me and he somehow dies and still make it a movie with a message. So I, believe it or not, until maybe the last 30 minutes of the film, thought there was a minor chance, 5% say, that they were going to kill him off. So to answer your question, Mike, the suspense of him possibly dying, probably not. But
Well, the thing is, there's a scene at the end where I never had any real doubt that they were getting him back, and yet there was a scene at the very end of the film where I still felt tense and nervous for him, even though intellectually I knew he was going to make it. I mm-hmm. guess there was enough, and I think that speaks to, again, sort of the quality of how well put together the film is that you get this sort of suspense, even though it's Matt Damon, and I mean, it would be a fucking bummer of a film. You know, it called "We Failed to Bring Matt Damon Home Back from Mars." Right? It's
the dead Martian,
and I guess you could have gone to the point where like the captain might have sacrificed herself to save him, which would be sort of a bittersweet ending. Yeah, we got Matt Damon back, but we kind of flushed another person down the tube to do it, and wasted like 2 years of the other characters' lives to trade one life for the next. But yeah, it does speak to, again, the idea of the value we hold life. And I got to say, I don't think this is far fetched. In that, I think if something like this really happened, I don't know that I could say the same about the Russian or Chinese government. But I certainly believe NASA would throw everything at the wall, damn the cost, to bring the person back.
I, you know what, Mike? I agree 100% because I don't know, for folks who aren't American citizens that listen to this podcast, and we do have a number from Australians to British, Canadians, Mexicans, and whatnot. Though, to be honest, their governments would probably do the same, but I don't know. However, the U.S., at least in the U.S. military, when someone is left behind, dead or alive, they go back to get them. And so that may not be in all cases. I mean, we have American hostages and we quote unquote do not, negotiate with terrorists or hostage takers, depending on your definition of terrorist. But other countries do and have been successful to bring folks home. But when it comes to U.S. soldiers, and I would assume NASA too, even though NASA is not a military installation of the U.S. government, but a governmental institution only, they would go and bring back the boys home, whether dead or alive.
If they could.
Yeah.
I mean, if there was no way to get Matt Damon back, there's no way to get Matt Damon back. But if there's a sliver of hope, I think they would. And there will be bureaucrats who will say, well, is it worth it? You know, there will be daytime talk show hosts who would have that argument, you know, just to drive up ratings. And it's not
well, and that's really, I think, one of the more interesting aspects of this movie is NASA's whole viewpoint on the situation from a PR perspective. Because when they first find out that Matt Damon is alive, their reaction isn't, oh, yay, he's alive. Their action is
like, oh, shit.
We already yeah. told everybody he's dead.
Well, and Eric, another good aspect, too, is that when they decide to get Matt Damon back, that they are debating, is it worth doing it? But they're debating if it's, is it worth doing it? Not because is it, you know, financially or PR worthy to do it. They're debating about it, whether or not if we do it, can we do it? And the meaning, will we lose other lives if we did it? Would it be completely right. impossible and therefore stupid to try? So it shows that there, it makes the government, the U.S. government, at least in this film, look more altruistic, human. Yeah, more human rather than the typical bad guy that we see in other films, which is oh, we better do and it because.
That's another great thing about this film is that there is no villain except for time and Mother Nature. You know, there's no last minute mustache twirling government official or any other human or alien force in this. It's just the race against time to get to this guy before he died.
It was interesting aspect of the movie that NASA had the whole PR angle that they had to worry about.
Yeah, yeah. And that's interesting how that the book, which you mentioned you read, was only 387 pages. Never mind this movie, which is still a long movie, is 221 minutes. We're still able to put in these details that you would think some movies would just, or books would just brush. And
there's the one guy that's like, that won't let the mission commander tell the crew that Matt Damon's still alive.
That's the head of NASA.
I think he's the closest to a villain, and they make him come off actually worse in the book than they do in the movie.
Right. Well, like, for example, there's always frequently there's the, you know, it's, if this goes wrong, it's not on you, it's on me, it's all about me. And there is a line like that in there, but it's somebody else who says it, right? When they said, so, you know, what are we going to decide? And I think it's the engineer from the Jet Propulsion Lab said, we don't have to decide, he does.
Mm-hmm.
All right, yeah. And I think by having another character point that out, you know, you do have to realize that how much weight is sitting on this guy's shoulders, because it isn't just his life, it's all these things. And like they point out that, I'm pretty sure they point out at one point in the film where he said, right now he's a hero who died on Mars, right? And if he's alive and we fail to bring him back, then we're the fuck-ups who failed to bring back Damon back.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Mike, that's a good point, because right after they come out and say that Matt Damon's character is still alive, the first question asked of Jeff Daniels, who plays the head of NASA, is, are you going to resign, sir? So immediately, you know, he already knows.
Best press conference ever. You know, it's like, because he's just giving these very short, I don't know, we're working on it. You know, he's very short, terse responses. So it hits the reality, right? The reality. And what's one of the reasons NASA cooperated with this film? Well, PR purposes. They know that long term, movies like this and Apollo 13 and Interstellar and Gravity are good for business. And they stated at the end where Matt Damon, spoiler warning, is back on Earth. And he's in with a room full of cadets, right? Who are like, oh, what was it like to eat shit-covered potatoes, right? You know, it's...
And by the way, that scene irritated the fuck out of me because it was completely made up, not in the book at all.
Okay. It felt out of place.
It was completely out of place.
And we'll get to that, I guess, unless you guys want to bring it up now, but...
That's all I had to say about it.
But let me just say this, and I the one thing, like... that I felt, and it's, I don't know how you get around it structurally. Like I said, there is the thing that I don't want to say bothered me, but kept it from feeling, let's say, like, say Apollo 13 or Gravity, was because of the time you were dealing with. It was, holy shit, if we don't do this right now, Matt Damon's going to die in a year and a half.
Yeah, right.
And so, like, and even Matt Damon, I understand this is his character. Like, let's say compared to Tom Hanks in Castaway. I don't get, other than his disdain of the disco music, which I don't understand why nobody else had music on their laptops. but I don't get the sense of a guy who's like sad and desperate and lonely. Although admittedly, this is exactly the kind of person they pick for these missions. right? If you couldn't handle being alone for a prolonged period of time, you never would have passed the psych profile. You never would have been put in a space capsule.
Right.
So I understand logistically it's probably more true to life, but it undermined to me a little bit of the immediacy, the tension, and the drama of what they could have had. And like stuff like, for example, the Apollo 13 scene. We don't really know what Matt Damon's resources are, right? And we just kind of watch him do it and go, oh, that's neat. Oh, that's interesting. You know, here, their problems they're solving are either with materials that we don't realize that they have, right? They don't have the scene of them like dumping all the contents on the table, saying, we have this material to make the square peg fit in the round hole, or round head peg in the square hole, whichever one.
Well, and that's one of the significant differences between the movie and the book, is that all that is in the book. The book takes the form of his journal entries.
Right.
And I actually thought it was a perfect solution for the movie to have them be video journal entries, because that way you get to see Matt Damon on the screen. Instead of reading everything that he's written, but he does a lot of that in the book, saying, I have this resource, I have that resource, I have to use them to accomplish this X. So what's the answer? And the book is a lot of that problem solving, him just writing it out, his thought process.
Okay.
I'll like to answer a couple of those points that you made, Mike. I actually did have Phil suspense when they say, well, oh my God, we got to do this, because if we don't, he'll be dead in 180 days. Because I think the film did really good in showing Matt Damon, as well as the folks back on Earth, mapping out how much food he has, how much this he has, until, you know, point B, where he suddenly won't have enough food and he will die, or enough water and he will die. And so I did get that suspense. So that
well, I'm saying it, but it's not like, to me, it wasn't like there's like real white knuckle suspense I had watching Gravity, or where, because that was like, not you're going to die eventually. It's you're going to die now. You know, it was just the lack of immediacy. I'm not saying it didn't.
It was just the degree to which.
All right. So I guess that's matter of personal. Right. Preference, I guess. I mean, both work for me.
And because Matt Damon's going around making pirate jokes, you know, and
that's actually straight from the book.
And I could see that, and I could see, especially as somebody, we go through mood swings. He never seems to be all that concerned about dying.
Well, Mike, I wanted to bring that up eventually tonight, but we can bring it up now. Which is the interesting thing about this character is that there is no moments in this film at all where he is, woe is me, what's the point, I'm going to die. He always thinks about everything as a problem that has to be finished and given a solution. And he does that in this film. And so he always has an upbeat. So they never show the mood swings. I don't know if the book has mood swings. Again, I like your point. Okay, and I like your point, Mike, which is, you know, obviously the type of human being that would be drafted by NASA to do such a mission would have a certain type of personality that they wouldn't have these mood swings and whatnot, so they would think a certain way. So that obviously explains some of it. But it is curious. I did notice that too, Mike. But again, I had just seen The Leftovers and The Walking Dead, where, you know, everybody was trying to think as positive as possible. And so I guess because that was an after effect, never mind the fact that you mentioned, which is, you know, the character, the type of person that they would have for such a mission.
I've compared this to Gravity sort of in the negative in terms of tension. But like the one thing everybody had pointed out is that in Gravity, there's no way in hell Sandra Bullock's character ever would have ended up in a capsule, ever. Because right. She's so unstable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Now, that adds something to the character drama, right? But yeah. For something that I do believe he would be much closer to what a person was. And he does have, like at the end of the film, that's where I start really feeling the tension with one exception of one scene earlier, and that is, you know, when he's strapped in and ready to go, and you can feel his, oh, fuck, I'm going to die, you know, moment, yeah. right, when they're about yeah. to relaunch him into orbit,
yeah.
Then they basically didn't do much more than put his ass into a catapult, right? You know, it's basically what they're doing.
That's right.
Now we're sending into space naked. Oh, thank you. There you feel, because again, it's much more. Again, the impact is immediate, but his emotion is there, because now the danger has gone from theoretically in a year and a half I'm going to die to I'm going to, oh shit, this is fucking crazy. You know?
Yeah, well that's true. I mean, obviously that scene is similar to Gravity, which is the immediacy is now, not, you know, a year and a half from now. Even though the year and a half, that's the thing that's cool about this film, in my opinion, is that even though it's a year and a half away, unless something is done, and something done meaning like 1 in 100, you know, all these other things, he's gone, even if he's dead. And then when we do have the moment in like this film, just as we have in almost any film that is supposed to be similar to this, which is there's going to be a malfunction and something blows up and it kills his crops. And even then, when all his crops die, he still has another 180 days of survival, because he still at least has the potatoes that he's stored from prior, you know. So the immediacy of that, I see all of the points you're making, and I could see how the ending was probably the most exciting for you, because, you know, that was more like, oh my god, there's a chance he could die here.
And again, all of this is parsing fine points, right? Just looking for things to talk about. Cause again, it's not like I was saying, boy, this is boring. I don't believe he's in danger or anything. It's just a matter of the degree of involvement. And they do really keep you, boy, you know, I've never seen potato growing quite so engaging, right? If you want to go the opposite direction, right? I've seen people stranded in space done in ways that had me terrified. I wasn't so terrified in this, but man, they're potato growing. I've never been riveted by potato growing quite the same way. Or how to rehydrate dried feces. You know, it's.
That's a fair point, Mike. I mean, some movies have done that. There's a couple that I remember were like this recently, and I forget the names of them. But one of the ones I do remember from a few years ago that starred Peter Fonda, and that film was called Yule's Gold. And that was about a beekeeper. And the beekeeper part was just, you know, his job and what he did and whatnot. And you learn so much in that film about beekeeping. And yet it's like, so that's boring, but it was riveting. And oddly, this film does the same thing as Yule's Gold did for what beekeeping did, does for potato farming and whatnot. So it is curious how scenes that you would think would be boring as hell, and like, how could you make this into a motion picture where there's any interest or suspense, and yet they do it so well? And that's just unbelievable.
And as I mentioned before, I think it really just has how the actors and the writing kind of keep everyone's attention on there. Because, you know, honestly, I don't even recall ever looking at my watch once during these scenes. I mean, usually this is the part where I'm kind of like taking a look like, okay, how long is this going to go on for? But, you know, I didn't have that. I mean, because I was really curious as to how he was going to pull off his next move, or what NASA was going to do, how they were going to be the time and everything like that. I mean, most of these things would be, in other films, absolute snore fest, but they just do it so well in this regard.
Well, and really one of the most awesome parts of the whole story, both the book and the movie, is how when he's first presented with his situation. Well, first of all, I've got to say that the book has one of the best opening lines ever, which is the book just starts out, "I'm fucked." those are the first words of the book. And the thing about Matt Damon's character is that he starts trying to do this problem solving, and he starts with trying to figure out how to feed himself, how to survive, and how to get over to the other site. Before he even knows that NASA knows he's still alive. And it's a big leap of faith that NASA is eventually going to figure out that he's alive. But if he hadn't started doing what he did right when he did it, it would have been too late. And by the time NASA found out he was still alive, he wouldn't have been able to do it. So well, his whole instinct for survival and his problem solving nature saved himself, because he started solving the problem right in front of him instead of looking down the road and saying, oh, well, there's the roadblock there. He just solved problem A before worrying about B, C, D, and E.
Right. It reminds me of something that we sometimes tell our students when they're presented with a really big problem or a lot to do, which is, how do you eat an elephant? How do you eat an elephant? You eat it one bite at a time. Right?
Yes.
And you can't worry about eating the whole thing. You have to, like, he couldn't worry about how do I contact NASA until he'd made sure he had food and water to survive and oxygen to survive.
Right.
And he could, and then, because if he didn't have that, he would never make it to the other part. Right. And so all these things, he's, and again, this is the kind of person you would have. And it, you know, might be more dramatically interesting to have, Tom Hanks going nuts and talking to a volleyball. But that's not the person that would ever make it on that mission to Mars, and that's the kind of personality that they're highlighting. And it's a very positive message, you know. This is NASA propaganda, right? I mean, this is this is a scientist writing a novel about how scientists are cool and how science is cool. So of course he's not going to have a big pussy scientist crying about how he doesn't have any food or water or anything like that.
There was one scene though that was devastating, and that was when he said, "I just ran out of ketchup."
Oh yeah! Oh my God!
I don't care what anybody says about salsa; it's ketchup. Once you run out of that, forget about it. It's all. But no, that's a fair point, Mike. I mean, I don't want to be as blatant about it as you, but you're right. It is a propaganda for science, for scientists, for NASA, for anything that's cool that's related to
botany.
Botany, thank you. Said a word. So, you know, but anyway, go on, Eric.
And by the way, that's another line directly out of the book, was that Mars will come to fear my botany powers. that's a great line.
and let's also, because we're talking about, Matt Damon really, I mean, there's a section of the film where he's out for a bit, but he does have to carry this film. Because
indeed.
I've mentioned there are certain actors that I don't have any connection to at all. Right, I just don't feel for them. I don't buy them. I don't get engaged by them.
That would be Mark Wahlberg. And John Franco, whatever his name is.
Well, John Franco is just different. I just don't buy him as credibly intelligent. But it's so you have to have it. And we've seen this a lot in movies recently, where there's an assumption. Well, because we've cast a big name. And because they're the star of the film, and they're the central character in the film, the audience will care about them. And sometimes they don't. They don't give us any reason to root for a character. They don't give us any reason to like the character. And now you cast correctly, and the actor's charisma will cover a lot of that gap. But sometimes it's not enough, and so you end up feeling not emotionally involved in the film. In this case, I think it helps that the role is well written. You know, that he has a sense of humor, which helps get you on his side, right, and follow along. He wasn't bitching him, oh, leave me, those bastards. I was alive, they took off, right? We would immediately go, well, fuck you, die, you know?
Well, right. Mike, let me ask you this.
Performance helps, right? His performance was good. He had to do it, and he had nothing to play off of.
Well, we can say, based off of all the way back to, Jesus, almost 20 years ago, Good Will Hunting, Matt Damon has proven that he is a hell of a great actor, whether or not he is a box office draw. Let me ask you this, Mike. Though this film is Matt Damon's film, and the role was written well, and he is a damn good actor anyway, do you think that his name was purposely, in other words, was he hired because he's a big name, or was he hired because he's a good actor, and or was it a combination of both, because they knew he was a good actor, but they also knew he was a draw for audiences because people love Matt Damon?
Well, I don't think they were going to hire Jason Statham, right? I mean,
Phil, I'm going to jump in here, and I'm going to say that I can totally, like, having read the book, I can totally see somebody in Hollywood reading the book and going, oh my God, this is a part for Matt Damon. because he's just got the affable nature that comes across in the writing of the journal entries in the book. And I think it's a very natural fit.
Okay, that's good. And see, Mike, you brought up, you know, Jason Stratham or whatever his name is. I don't mean that. I meant, for example, you can take, you know, some of the best actors like Benedict Cumberbatch or Matt Damon or Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise or Ben Affleck, or, you know, you know who I'm talking about, Leonardo DiCaprio, and you could take all those guys, but, or George Clooney, and then you could take other guys who aren't big names but are as good as actors as they, and they could have plugged them into the spot. And yet, you know, for example, I can't think of any right now, but in the back in the day, you know, Robert De Niro and Jack Nicholson or whatever, but Robert Duvall was as damn good of an actor as any of them, but he always seemed to not be as big of a name because he wasn't as good looking or charismatic or whatever, but he was as hell of a good of an actor as any of them, and he could have played any role that they did. But they would always go for De Niro or Nicholson because those are the big names and everybody loves them and whatever. But here, could they have done the same thing? Or do you think they specifically went for Matt Damon, like Eric said, because they thought, oh, Matt Damon could play the role, plus he's a big name? Or
the fact that it's a big name is always a plus, right?
Yeah. Sure.
You know, that it's Joshua Sobotnik from Yonkers. If maybe a great actor, but nobody knows him, and therefore it's hard to put his name on the top of the title of a $100 million picture. So they're going to want a name. But Matt Damon, to his credit, is one of the few actors that's out there that I think has credibly done both drama and comedy, right? Let's say Liam Neeson, right? If you put Liam Neeson in this role, those jokes are coming across in a very different manner.
Even though his Super Bowl joke, role was pretty good, you know, the commercial.
Right, but his joke about, like, you know, so I'm a pirate, you know, Captain Blondebeard.
Yeah.
That would not work, or would read really differently with him doing it.
Sure.
Yeah, and there are just some actors that don't do funny well.
Sure.
I think Matt Damon has shown that he can do both the funny. I mean, he hasn't been in a lot of outright comedies, but he's been very funny in some of the things that he's done, and he's got that sort of charm that you need. And he's one of the few actors that is a big name that could do the drama, that can do the comedy, and that you can plausibly believe is a scientist, right? We've had this conversation too, right? Like going back to The Thing, you know, where whether or not a certain actor or actress that's cast is plausible as a scientist,
right? You mean Mary Elizabeth Winstead, for example,
right?
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
You know, there's a reason why Jeff Goldblum got every scientist role in the late '80s, early '90s.
Yep. No, that's fair. Yep. Yeah. No, I see your point. Yeah, that's a good point. Because, you know, like, for example, Jessica Chastain, right? She plays a scientist in Interstellar. She plays a basically a scientist in this film. Yet, you know, another actress probably couldn't pull it off. And Matt Damon is a perfect example of someone that was able to pull off being the scientist and yet being a tough guy in other films and such. So, yeah, right, yeah, that's a fair point. So, though we could see other actors playing this role, I think this was a dream thing by the producers where they said, oh, here's a role that's perfect for Matt Damon, as Eric said, because, oh, we can see it in the book. Never mind what you said, Mike, which is, oh, this is a guy that's played comedy, played action, played He-Man, played the sex symbol, played a scientist, played everything. This is perfect. Here's a dream role, a dream movie that's going to make huge money if we get the right director.
Well, and as I've mentioned, a lot of the lines in the movie come straight from the book, and they just roll naturally right off his tongue. It's just a good fit.
Very good.
Right, and we don't know with any of these films. Now, Matt Damon is not normally someone who's going to have to do a read, right? Who's going to have to audition.
Right.
But, you know, for a movie like this, that was a hot property, it's in demand, it's got Ridley Scott, you know, you might have had somebody say, come in, we want to try you out and see if you work for this. You know, so it could be that they maybe tried a Brad Pitt or whomever, you know, and maybe it didn't work. You know, maybe it just didn't quite click.
And that's possible too, Mike, because, I mean, we've seen a lot of roles by some damn good actors that were and did fantastic, and we know, you know, they weren't necessarily the first choice, right? I mean, we can go all the way back to Jaws, where they wanted Sterling Hayden, they wanted Paul Newman as Quinn, you know, and or Steve McQueen, you know, as Quinn, and then whatever reason it didn't work out, so they got Robert Shaw, a character actor, and he was fantastic. Or
Tom Selleck as Indiana Jones.
Well, that's I was going to bring another Spielberg up too, which was Close Encounters. He wanted Steve McQueen, and Steve McQueen decided not to do it because there's a scene where you cry in the movie, and he says, "I'm not known as a guy that cries my films. You know, I'm the He-Man, whatever. So I can't do the role." And they get Richard Dreyfuss, a character actor, and there you go. It's you know, history's made. So yeah, exactly. So it happens. But you're right. This film, I don't know the history behind this film, whether or not they said we want Matt Damon, let's get him, or they had like five different people, and Matt Damon was the one that, you know, said, all right, I'll do it for less, or I'll do it because of this or that. You know, who knows?
But I also think that this film would have been a hit regardless, because I think the marketing of this film was fantastic. Everybody knew it was coming out. Everybody seemed to want to see it. Now, there are certain people, like Pam cares a lot more than I do as to who's in a film.
Yeah,
she's much more likely to say, oh, Matt Damon's in the film, I like Matt Damon, let's go see the movie, than I would be.
Sure.
I mean, there are actors that I like to see in movies, but if they're in something shitty or that I have no interest in, they're not usually going to shift my interest.
Right.
And certainly there will be people who go, oh, you know, we want to see Matt Damon. Matt Damon's in, or that raises their interest. But yeah. I think, the same thing with the director. For some people, the fact that Ridley Scott made this movie makes them go, yeah, let's go see this. And other people would be, Ridley who?
Or other people that say, oh my God, Ridley Scott, his last two films sucked. So you don't know. Yeah, exactly. So you're going to have all different types of people who will say, oh, I'm not going to see that film because Tom Cruise sucks. I hate Tom Cruise. And then when they see it on VOD, oh my God, Edge of Tomorrow is one of the best films of last year. Why did I miss this film?
So, because you're a douche nozzle. That's why.
Exactly. So that's a fair point, Mike. There's a lot of number of reasons. I mean, I anything time that a film that Martin Scorsese directs, my ears are, you know, I'm suddenly like, oh, I have to sit. Maybe I may not see it, but I got to go. Oh, I got to see if it's any good. You know, so certain things. You know, Matt Damon's another one. You're like, oh, Matt Damon. Yeah, yeah. It may not be like Pam, where I go, oh, I got to go see the film because I just like Matt Damon. But it may pique my interest. You know, so. Like, believe it or not, when I heard Ridley Scott was coming out with The Martian, I was one of those people who was like, oh, I don't know if I want to see that because his last two films sucked. Prometheus and Exodus were horrible. Do I really want to see Ridley Scott now in the age of 70-something when he's lost it? And, of course, suddenly it comes out, the critics say, oh, this movie's awesome. And I go, oh, Matt Damon, Ridley Scott back to form? All right, I'm going to go see it. And then, of course, Eric and Abe both said it was great, so there you go.
Yeah, I actually have written down here, writing in the dark of the theater, and I wish I could remember what scene it was where I wrote down, more believable than Prometheus. obviously, just something about, not the fact that it's a, obviously this is hard science fiction and the other is whatever, space opera. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, I don't know what it was.
But I guess, you know, like in terms of, you know, you have partly like the fact that you have a botanist doing botany and, you know, not a geologist who can't follow his own maps, and other things. Oh, that was that's what it was. It's when he was stitching up his stomach.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, yeah. Very, very like Prometheus.
Where she's running around 5 minutes later. You know, and without
all over the place and getting tackled and somehow the wounds don't open again.
Yeah,
right. Right. And anybody wants to hear us rant for two hours, go back and listen to the Prometheus episode because
we were not pleased.
No, we tried to be.
Anyway,
yeah, I still think it works for me as a B movie, but you know, for Ridley Scott, you want, if you don't have Ridley Scott and a $150 million budget, whatever that was, to make a B movie. Right, that's, you're not doing Tremors 5, for God's
sake. Well, and by the way, I'm actually surprised Mike hasn't mentioned this. The author of the book has copped to a major infactuality, which is the setup of the
whole
situation.
There really is no Mars, I know.
Yeah. Well, no, not that, but that the atmospheric pressure on Mars is so low that a storm like the one at the beginning that sets everything in motion, it really never happens on Mars.
Also, another thing that was different too, that probably isn't factual, is they didn't talk about the gravity, the difference between Mars and Earth. And that bothered me a little bit throughout the movie. I'm going, shouldn't he be able to jump a little further? I mean, I just saw John Carter, and he was jumping 25 feet.
Well, I think John Carter is intentionally exaggerated.
And I think this one was intentionally ignored, the gravity.
Well, it was ignored because...
That's a fair observation. But,
well, first of all, it's about half of Earth's gravity, or 40%, something like that. And for most of what you're doing, you wouldn't notice it. If there was a scene where it's like, oh my God, this is so heavy, I can't move it. You know, or if there was a scene that required him to jump more than a foot off the ground, then I was worried about it. But given the expense that you'd have to do to simulate low gravity, like zero gravity, and obviously they had those zero gravity scenes in the spaceship.
But they should have at least, since they had those zero gravities in the spaceship, they should have at least had a throwaway line that discussed it.
Did they do that in the book, Eric? I don't know that it was necessary.
Eric, so, did they have it in the book? A throwaway line about the gravity of Mars?
No.
All right, so he ignores it in the book too. Okay, fair enough. So, hey, are you going to say something?
Yeah. Well, I'm not really strong in terms of like gravity and or like scientific physics and stuff like that. But how accurate was the plan for Matt Damon had to pull off to launch himself high enough into the atmosphere after removing all those pieces of the pod and be able to get to the craft?
Pretty sure that was fairly accurate.
Fairly accurate?
Yeah. Because the atmosphere is thin enough that you could have, if they'd secured it properly, you would have been able to get away with having the cameras on the outside of the pod.
Okay.
Right. And they do mention that, and I've said this before, it's my problem when they're inaccurate with science is when they just blatantly make up shit that isn't right for no good reason when there's perfectly reasonable alternatives.
You probably appreciated the fact when Matt Damon says to NASA through the computer, he goes, I lost all my micro organisms, so I can't grow anymore.
They mentioned that they lose the bacteria, and they got a lot of stuff right, but they don't pull out something that's unnecessary. You need to have some disaster happen, so I can forgive the fact that the storm was. And by the way, that's not something I would have realized because astrophysics is not my thing.
Right. The gravity one, though, that was as obvious. Anybody who knows anything about Mars or the planets would know that.
I think you're just infatuated with John Carter.
Yeah, well, it's the fact that there was nothing one way or the other. There was no point in the film where the gravity seemed to have mattered, except for when you get to the very end and with the liftoff, it would take less energy to lift off. And you wouldn't have as much resistance because there's too thin of an atmosphere.
But just walking around, I was wondering, why isn't he bouncing around a little easier?
Well, because usually we see the bouncing around, like on the moon.
Yeah, right.
Where the gravity is like 1/10 of what we have on Earth instead of 1/2. Sure. So it still wouldn't have been as big of a difference. So I don't think if there was a dramatic moment in the film that hinged on the level, the amount of gravity, then I might have been an issue, but...
And you know what, though? You're right. I mean, again, this is... The gravity had nothing to do with his survival on Mars. It was just something in the background of my mind that's saying, I wonder why they're not portraying the true gravity of Mars.
There was a reason. It was budget.
Yeah, you're probably right, yeah. Exactly. It was like something that wasn't necessary to really pay attention to because we had more important things to talk about, I guess.
Yeah, it wouldn't have added much to the story.
Yeah. What else?
And by the way, at the end, spoiler warning, that whole thing at the end where he pokes a hole in his spacesuit, yeah, not in the book. I was a little pissed.
Oh, the Iron Man thing?
Yeah, the whole Iron Man bullshit? No, that's fucking stupid. I was a little irritated with that.
How did it play on the book then?
In the book, I mean, they had to do a last-minute adjustment just like they did in the movie, but it worked. And they sent the guy out on a tether, and he grabbed him out of the pod.
Oh.
And the problem is, and this is Hollywood 101, right? And it's, well, we
it's
haven't...
It's Argo. you know, 101, where let's have the Iranians chase the plane down the jet path just because it makes it more exciting.
Well, because it makes it more exciting, but you cannot have the star not be involved in his own rescue. Right? It's what he's done. It doesn't matter that he has figured out a way to grow the first plants on Mars. It doesn't matter that he's figured out a way to take something that has, you know, a 24-hour battery charge and figure out a way to drive it halfway across the freaking planet.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't matter that he's dug up a probe that's been buried for 20 years on Mars.
And has a nuclear power plant in the back of his seat.
Yeah, and I was waiting for that to turn into Chekhov's power plant. But he also has to be able to be the one to get himself over to the woman on the tether, right? Because he has to be involved in his own rescue, especially since he's a guy. You know,
it was stupid.
It was unnecessary.
Now, Eric, let me ask you this. This is just for curiosity's sake. The heritages and the genders of the characters, are they the same in the book?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Very good. Mm-hmm. I was just curious if they changed it around, because if they're willing to change the Iron Man scene around, I was curious if they would be more apt to change other things around, too. So, okay.
No, but that was all relatively the same. The one thing they did kind of, it was still there, but they didn't call it out in the movie like they did in the book, is that Kate Mara's character is obviously the hot one. And there's this whole thing where she has this thing going on with one of the other astronauts, and Jessica Chastain's character before the mission told all the guys, if any of you hit on her, you're off the fucking mission. So they were sneaking around the whole time.
And what, at least in the movie, Kate Mara's character and the other guy, they hook up and they have a baby at the end.
Right. Because that scene in the movie where she kisses his helmet
means nothing.
I can't believe I just did that. Yep. And he said, I kind of liked it. That it like makes a whole lot more sense in the book because there's all the setup leading up to that point.
Ah, gotcha. Very good. Let's see what else. Speaking of Kate Mara, Mike, was she as good in this movie as she was in the Fantastic Four remake?
She was fine in that. She was okay.
Yeah, actually, yeah, they said the acting was actually good. It was really just
the script was awful. The script was miserable, and that's the reason why that. Which is funny because it was the casting that people had problems with before the movie came out. You know, she was fine. Right. She was funny. I mean, she didn't really have a lot. The astronauts didn't have as much to do in this film, so it wasn't, you know, like a huge role. You know, I don't think she's winning an Oscar for her role. I don't think anybody on the spaceship is, even though they all did were perfectly fine in their performances.
Yeah, that's what I meant earlier when I said Jessica Chastain's character. Never mind any of the other four astronauts besides Chastain could have been any actor or actress to do it because they weren't really developed that much. So to have Chastain to pay whatever they had to pay for Chastain was kind of a head scratcher when they could have just had another person do it.
Small time actress or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think it was what you said, Mike, which is
I think
a lot
more
of folks wanted.
Chastain is always better.
Oh no! No,
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying that basically what I think Mike summed it up perfectly, which was there was a bunch of people that wanted to work with Ridley Scott, and she may have been one of them, and that's how she got the role. Not because they said this is a role that Chastain will shine in. It was more like,
that's a distinct possibility.
But you know, it also helps. She's a name, and I get that. So this doesn't necessarily quite fit. But sometimes, if you have a small part, making sure you get a damn good actor in the small part because they will bring more to it than if you had just gotten, you know, the person doing the commercial for the local auto mall.
Well, and I'm agreeing with you, Mike, because Sean Bean is someone that I would pay money to see because I love it's a good fair point, which is certain actors people will want to see, and Chastain is one. And for me, it would be Bean, and so you know that it's whatever. So
right, but I'm thinking of like remember One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, right? You have Jack Nicholson,
Yeah, Christopher Lloyd.
Ryan, but you also have right in very small roles. Christopher Lloyd and Brad Dourif and David Boyle. All these there as background characters. Now, none of them were really anybody important, but they were good actors, and that's how they became eventually successful, commercially successful actors. But you had to get a good actor for small parts because it's small. They do bring a lot of texture instead of just getting random stand-ins.
Right. Yeah, absolutely, and that's a fair point because a lot of folks in this film are character roles or character actors who've had fairly big roles here or there, but eventually could be the Danny DeVito or the Peter Boyle or the Christopher Lloyd and become a named actor, and so that's a fair point, Mike. And those folks and just using that film. The Cuckoo's Nest film is an excellent comparison of the supporting cast.
Now, that said, I'm usually in favor of finding really talented people who are unknowns because I think they're out there, and Cuckoo's Nest would be an example of how I'd prefer it because those people were nobodies to start.
Sure, yeah.
But
George Lucas with the Star Wars films, right?
Right, and Harrison Ford, right, was pretty much a nobody before that, even though I know he had been in American Graffiti. But, it's a big budget film. They want names, so get names. Names help justify the budget. Especially if they're willing to work for scale or for a low salary.
Yep. No, and we've seen it in a lot of films. Obviously we're sidetracking a little here, but, you know, Jaws had a lot of good actors in it, but all of them were character actors, you know, and suddenly, boom, you know, you get three awesome performances. So it happens, and this film was a perfect example of a bunch of good character actors. No matter how great Matt Damon was and he carried this film, the other 95% of the actors in this film all held their own and were just fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Well, and Michael Pena is a good actor, and anybody who has not seen End of Watch, I recommend that movie highly. It's him and Jake Gyllenhaal, couple of police officers who have a rough day. It's not a happy movie, but it's a really good one. So I recommend that as a watch.
Yeah. And it's on Netflix right now, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
Yep. Go on.
Oh, I was going to, I was wondering, you know, what do you guys think of the soundtrack overall? I thought it was actually pretty kind of clever, you know, using the running gag for the whole soundtrack of the 70s music.
Well, the moment they put in, actually, to be honest, I did like the soundtrack. I mean, obviously, they used a lot of period songs, and it is hard to believe that it would only be disco songs because, you know, if this is like 10 years in the future or whatever, there, you know, everything's digital, so they could have the entire friggin' Library of Congress on books, movies, and music on one little thumb drive, probably. So it's hard to believe that they only had disco. But the way they used the music in this film, the soundtrack, never mind using David Bowie in a excellent scene in outer space where the Ares 3 is coming back. I thought it was a fantastic soundtrack. Oddly, I don't remember too much of the "quote unquote" real soundtrack, meaning the music made.
Yeah, there wasn't much original scores in there. I think it was mostly a lot of songs used in there.
Yeah,
and I don't think it was the entire astronaut crew's music listing, except for just one of the astronauts had a love for the disco and stuff like that. But of course, you do have a point that, you know, it's kind of strange when you have such a long trip that no one else brought their own music or stuff.
Well, you can't.
Well, that was one thing.
Sometimes you run out of room for the porn and the music. I mean, it's.
I guess you can't have both, I suppose.
Now, Eric, was it in the book? Was it just the music thing?
Oh, absolutely. But it was actually, it came across a little better in the book. Because it was a better job at doing the jarring transition in the log entries. Because he would be writing a log entry about trying to figure out how to grow his potatoes, and then that entry would end and the next one would begin. He'd be like, "Disco? Are you fucking kidding me? It's all disco." The abrupt change between the subject of trying to solve a problem and his hatred of the disco music that he was stuck with because it's the only music that's there, kind of added had a little more impact in the book than it did in the movie.
Well, now, you mean to tell me that I know it would have taken him a couple of hours to get it, but he couldn't have asked him to stream him something?
Mike, let me ask you this, Mike, and I just brought it up a little while ago, which is, you know, say this is 10 years, 15 years in the future. Obviously the technology has changed, maybe not the big leaps we see in science fiction films usually, but still, it's changed. You know what I mean? In the past 10 years, Steve Jobs changed the world, for Christ's sakes. But.
Yeah, but even he's not bringing ABBA back.
But my point is that, actually, I did have an ABBA song on my playlist for my daughter's birthday party the other day. But the point is, wouldn't they be able to store, like I said, the Library of Congress of all movies, books, and music, never mind porn, all on just a couple of thumb drives? So you would think that the selection would be that huge, and especially for such a trip across, you know, 2 years, 4 years, if you do round trip.
I would think, but there's a limit. You have a laptop. Now the laptop in, you know, whatever, let's say this is 20 years in the future.
Yep.
All right, which is feasible.
Yep.
You know, obviously would have a lot more memory. And I could right now, you know, easily store dozens or hundreds of movies and thousands or of songs on my laptop. Yeah. Well, I mean, God, I've got a 128 gig thumb drive. And that's cheaper. They go much higher. They go, don't they have some like up to 240 now, or?
That's right. Yeah. So, never mind. It's 20 years from now.
Yeah. So never mind 20 years from now. But I imagine they also have important stuff in there that goes beyond that, that might limit the space they have. And, you know, you figure you bring enough movies to last you for the 2 years you're on this mission.
He had Happy Days.
Oh yeah, you know,
that's right.
You got the whole series, and that ran for like 10 seasons. So that would probably eat up all their memory. Because he's thinking, okay, now do I want to download Happy Days? Do I want to have it? Now, if I have it in standard definition, then I can download my music library. But I think I really need the Fonz in HD. and especially in this post-converted 3D. Happy Days, high definition, extra high definition. That's what I want, and that means no music.
Now, there was one. There's one little tiny little scene from the book that I was sad didn't make it into the movie, and it's really just a tiny little detail. But he is using a laptop in the story, and he goes to try and use it outside and doesn't stop and think. And he's like, well, it's cold, but the battery should be fine. And then he goes to do it, and he comes back later. He's like, oh, yeah, the L in LCD stands for liquid. That wasn't the best idea.
Oh, that's good. And sometimes it's the little things, right? And I love the line when they said, well, they get the picture of him. And they're like, we can't see his face. We can't use that.
You know, well, we could ask him to take the helmet off, but
But that's the sort of stupid things that I imagine people would say. Let me ask, I'm wondering how many people got the whole soul thing, right?
What do you mean? Right.
Instead of saying days, because a Martian day is not the same as an Earth day.
Oh, I got it. Yeah.
I imagine you guys got it because I have respect for your intelligence. Yeah. I'm just wondering. How many other people, like, did they understand that that's what they were saying when they said it's 348 souls?
I'll tell you what the truth, Mike. Souls, I assume, meant days, but by Martian days.
Right.
But the thing I couldn't understand, because I'm a stupid American, is what the fuck is a kilometer? I was what? They go, it'll be 2,000 kilometers. I go, I'm waiting for the translation. Do it. And they wouldn't do it. I was like, God damn it.
Scientists actually do use the metric system.
Yeah, I know they do. But for me, I don't know none of that shit.
Wait a minute. You, with all your Canadian horse shit, you don't know your metrics?
I'm only a Quebecer, my friend. That Quebec should be independent.
Well, I'm sorry, metrics are fucking French, dude. I mean, it's the Système International.
Well, I don't know.
Which is actually what the scientists use, not the damn metric system, because they use Celsius and we use Kelvin. But anyway,
One of my favorite.
Absolute zero is Kelvin, my friend. But yes. Anyway, go on. Yes.
One of my favorite little details from the book that did not make it into the movie is that he, I'm not going to tell you what it is, but he actually does come up with his own unit of measurement while he's on Mars in the process of trying to figure out how to get to the other site.
Something like a smoot?
Why can't you tell
us? He has to measure a something that is something per something per something per something. It's just way too long to say over and over again, so he just like comes up with another name that's shorter and more fun.
Very good. All right. So the book's interesting just for these little cute little things that didn't transfer to the movie. Let's see. Any further things anybody wanted to mention about the film or things from the book that you wanted to mention? Eric, anybody that we want to say something that we missed?
Movie good, fire bad.
Right, well, I think the movie was a good adaptation for what you can do in that amount of time on the screen, and I think the book is better and still completely worth reading, even if you've already seen the movie,
or vice versa, for that matter, right?
Well, again, this is why I'm always an advocate for movie first, book after, because first of all, I think most of us went into the film knowing or suspecting he's making it out alive, so that's not the twist, right? That's not what's going to keep you on your seat. Sure. But the book will add a lot more that's not in the film and will enrich it. And again, so it's you can either read the book and go, oh, wow, that makes so much more sense, or that helps me understand that character so much more. Now I understand why there was the kiss on the space helmet.
Right.
As opposed to sitting there in the theater and going, where the fuck is that scene, dude? How'd you take out my fucking favorite scene in the book, man?
You know, I did have a couple moments like that. But for the most part, they left in all the crucial elements of the story.
Right.
Which is basically that Matt Damon got stuck on Mars.
Well, and other stuff too, but.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. So I guess unless anybody wants to bring up another scene or aspect that they wanted to bring up that they had planned to bring up that we haven't talked about, I guess we could go around, give our final thoughts. So, Abe, is there any other scenes? And if not, give your final thoughts.
Man, I think we covered most of everything. I definitely recommend this movie. By the time this episode's out, I mean, it could be out of theaters. But I still suggest you guys listen, go see it as soon as you can. It's a great film. Also, check out the book. I know I'm going to when I get a chance. It's a great film. A lot of personality, great performances all around, fantastic visuals, fun soundtracks, and it's really engaging. And I think it's one of the stronger films of 2015. So thumbs up on my end.
All right. I'll go second. I would pretty much say everything Abe said. The movie is really good. I think it still will be at theaters because it's still very successful. It was the best top movie of last weekend, for crying out loud. So I figure it'll still be here another 3 or 4 or 5 weeks, even by the time this episode is released. It's a very, very, very good film. Hard science versus, if you like Gravity, that type of stuff, that's the type of science fiction we got. It's much more like that than, say, Interstellar or Star Wars or anything like that. High recommend. Probably will be on my top 10 other genre list. I'm not sure where it will fall, but it definitely will be pretty close. And so far this year, with Jurassic Park, Mad Max, and now The Martian, Hollywood has put out 3 very big budget genre films that are all really good, I thought.
Rogue Nation too, but Mission Impossible.
Oh yeah,
that was a good one. Yeah, and some will say even Crimson Peak for that matter. So Hollywood's done pretty good this year, and Martian is definitely right there with at least the first few. Crimson Peak obviously didn't do as well, but the others for sure, absolutely. Mike?
Well, I think this is the kind of film when they expanded the Oscars from 5 Best Pictures to 10. I think, and that was like right after The Dark Knight got snubbed, and a movie like this or Gravity where it's both commercially successful, popular with the audience, and liked by the critics. So I have a feeling this is going to get an Oscar nomination. Won't win. Well, no, it's not that, oddly enough. It's because you have, like this weekend, you've got Peanuts and Spectre opening up. So you're going to start getting the holiday movies, and this may get pushed out finally. But that means that probably when the Oscar noms come out the end of January, I would not be shocked to see this make a return trip out into theater. So if you still want to see it on the big screen, and I would personally recommend seeing it on a big screen because because it is that whole spectacle thing, that you'll get the opportunity to do it there. And if you can do it, do it. And remember, NASA's watching you.
The Martian is a good movie. You should try and see it on the big screen. It is fun. It has moments of tension. Some cool disco tracks. And the book is even better. So go see the movie in the theater if you can, and then read the book, particularly if you have any affinity for science or math. There's a whole bunch of that in the book. I think it's an awesome story and one everybody should check out.
All right, very good. So that's Ridley Scott's return to form, The Martian, starring Matt Damon, among others. Screenplay by Drew Goddard and authored by Andy Weir, and along with some other fine people behind the scenes, including Darius Vosky of cinematography and Pietro Scalia editing, and some music, though overshadowed by the disco, by Henry Gregson Williams. So, with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right, thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about The Martian tonight. Come back next time, we'll be talking about something else.
And I learned